Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Friday, the 30th of July, 2021. I'm Joe Vicknicki with the local news. Superior Court judge has ruled Alaska's new ranked choice voting system and open primary are legal. Judge Gregory Miller rejected arguments that the new election method violates the right of free association. A legal challenge was filed by the Alaska Independence Party, a Libertarian Party member, and a Republican attorney. Miller's decision, if it stands, clears the way for the state to conduct the 2022 elections by the rules that voters adopted last year with Ballot Measure 2. The new system gives less power to political parties. In the open primary, all candidates, regardless of affiliation, would appear on one ballot, and the top four vote-getters advance to the general. On the November ballot, voters would be asked to rank the candidates 1 through 4. If no candidate wins a majority in the first round, the last-place finisher is eliminated. Those ballots are reallocated to the voters' next choice until one candidate wins a majority. The plaintiffs in the case have not yet announced whether they'll appeal the decision to the state's Supreme Court. Petersburg's Borough Assembly Monday may discuss an extension for the borough manager and vote on several land issues. Steve Giesbrecht has been the borough's manager for nearly a decade. He's asking for a 5-year extension for his contract, which would run through October of 2027, along with a 5% salary increase next year. That would bump his annual pay to $127,000. Assemblymember Bob Lynn has requested consideration of the extension. The Assembly also will discuss the form it uses for evaluating the manager. Also on the agenda for Monday's meeting, a discussion on dropping one of the parcels the borough has requested from the state for transfer. It's a remote aircraft navigational aid site on Frederick Point. The Federal Aviation Administration has done some cleanup work on that land, but the state has documented remaining arsenic contamination on the soil there. The Assembly also will reviewing the state's latest decision on other state lands to be transferred to the borough. Those parcels are near Cape Fanshawe, Thomas Bay, Frederick Point, Duncan Canal, Falls Creek, Blind Slough, and Woodpecker Cove. The borough has also been granted over 14,000 acres total of state lands, and so far the state has approved about 2,000 acres of that for transfer. Monday is the second reading and public hearing on an ordinance for an electrical department bond issue, and Utility Director Carl Hagerman will be presenting information on electrical rate hikes that would be needed to repay that debt. The Assembly also will consider sending a letter thanking Senator Lisa Murkowski for her work seeking funding for a new hospital building. There will also be updates from the Petersburg Medical Center and a discussion on next steps for the borough's code on zoning and development. The meeting starts at noon Monday in Borough Assembly Chambers, and KFSK will broadcast it live. People can participate in person or by Zoom. Register ahead of time with the borough clerk at 772-5405 to take part online. A lone killer whale that was reported to have beached itself on Prince of Wales Island yesterday has freed itself, according to federal biologists. NOAA Fisheries spokesperson Julie Fair says that killer whale was able to refloat with the incoming tide and left the area around 3 in the afternoon.
Reports from the scene indicate that the whale was a little bit slow at first and meandered around a little bit and then swam away.
Video on social media showed people standing around the roughly 20-foot-long marine mammal as it lay on seaweed-covered rocks with several boats nearby. The orca was reported to be calling out as Good Samaritans tried to keep the whale wet. Fair says biologists are gathering photos and videos of the whale.
We're trying to determine if it was a known killer whale, if so, what pod it was from, and to assess its condition and any injuries it might have. And knowing that will just help us further our scientific understanding of killer whales.
Though other whales were initially reported in the area, Fair says they swam away before this orca was able to free itself. Fair says NOAA has no evidence the stranding was related to Wednesday's magnitude 8.2 earthquake that triggered tsunami warnings and advisories along much of Alaska's coastline. The beached orca was originally reported to NOAA by a captain and crew of the MV Steadfast. Strandings of marine mammals can be reported on the hotline 877-925-7773. This summer, Canada closed most of British Columbia's commercial salmon fisheries. Declining stocks were to blame for the drastic conservation measures. As Sage Smiley reports, Southeast Alaska shares coastline and transboundary rivers with BC. So what could this mean for this region?
Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, the federal agency that manages Canada's fisheries, effectively ended the 2021 commercial salmon season on the West Coast in late June. Canada's fishing industry was stunned, says BC Seafood Alliance Executive Director Christina Burridge.
First Nations have harvested salmon forever, and post-contact salmon canneries are what in a sense built this province, and to be now in this situation seems really tragic to me.
The closure came just weeks after Canada announced a more than half a billion dollar plan to revitalize its flagging Pacific salmon stocks in BC and Yukon Territory. But Burridge says DFO's move erased most of the Canadian fleet's entire year.
The minister's announcement and most subsequent media coverage has said that it's 60%. In terms of the number of actual fisheries, that is correct. In terms of landed volume, it is 80%. And for gillnet fisheries, it's about 95%.
Canadian government officials say this has been a long time coming. Sarah Murdoch is a Vancouver-based fisheries policy manager with Canada's federal government.
I know it was a bit of a surprise to many, but those that have been close to the industry and close to Pacific salmon fisheries here, at least in the BC coast, recognize that the overall level of catch has been dropping significantly for some time.
So what does Canada's salmon shutdown mean for its Alaska neighbors? From a marketing standpoint, not much, says McKinley Research Analyst Dan Lesh in Juneau.
Alaska dwarfs BC, and so anything that happens in those markets is not going to be a big impact on our fisheries. For instance, Canada produces only about 0.017%, so less than 0.1% of sockeye globally. That's as of 2019.
BC's largest wild salmon market is Chinook, about 14% of the global market in recent years. But its shares of the other four salmon species represent less than 2% of worldwide production. So while the closures are devastating for BC, they shouldn't move world markets. Still, Lesh says the shutdown isn't good for perception of wild salmon as a sustainable product. Concerns about declining food sources for killer whales have prompted some in the Pacific Northwest to avoid Chinook salmon.
Of course, that doesn't make sense for protecting the orcas if the salmon are coming from a different area and a different stock. But so that's my broader concern with some of these declining stocks.
State fisheries managers say BC's experience isn't likely to be repeated in Alaska. Southeast management biologist Troy Tinas says Alaska has safeguards in place to keep salmon runs from dropping too far, allowing spawning fish to keep moving up rivers and streams. Drastic measures like widespread closures aren't in the nature of Alaska's dynamic management, where biologists can time openings at will.
When the fish and game is concerned about stocks, if there's a if a stock is not making escapement after a number of years, those stocks can be listed or recommended to the Board of Fisheries as a stock concern. And we do have several stock concerns that are in Southeast Alaska right now.
The Chinook on the transboundary rivers Unuk and Chilkat are among the current Southeast stocks of concern. Stikine and Taku Kings, also both transboundary rivers, are proposed to be added to the list. Burridge with the BC Seafood Alliance says she admires Alaska's proactive strategies, which involve long-range management plans and a lot of public input.
Basic things like stock assessment in Canada have been starved for at least two decades, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're looking at these closures, that the work simply hasn't been done. And to my mind, and I suspect most Alaskans would agree with me, that the foundation of good fisheries management is good stock assessment.
The sacrifice being made by BC fishermen will only be worthwhile, she says, if there's more investment in research and restoration of fish habitat.
Salmon, as you know, are doubly vulnerable because they depend both on the marine environment and the freshwater environment. And we have certainly compromised the freshwater environment here, in, particularly in southern BC.
But about a third of Canada's $500 million salmon rescue plan will likely be spent buying out permit holders.
I'm not for a moment saying that we should go fishing because people need to go fishing. We have to be extremely careful and cautious, but this is very, very devastating. And I think while some of the closures were probably necessary, many, it seems to me, are just putting the burden on the commercial sector rather than putting it on other sectors.
U.S. states and Canadian provinces work cooperatively to co-manage transboundary salmon runs through the Pacific Salmon Treaty. But the Canadian government says the shutdown on their end likely won't affect current allocations, as the treaty won't be renegotiated until 2028. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Alaska politicians, tribes, and advocacy organizations are celebrating passage of legislation that gives more money to crime victims. The bill changes the Victims of Crime Act, sending more money to the Crime Victims Fund. That was created in 1984 to help survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and other crimes. Money's sent directly to individuals as well as states, territories, and tribes to support victim services organizations. Previously, that money just came from fees paid by people convicted in federal court. It didn't include fines from settlements that don't go to trial. In signing the bill this month, President Biden said an increase in those types of agreements has led to a decrease in funding.
Between 2017 and today, the amount of money in these funds has gone down 92%, which has resulted in a 70% reduction in victims' assistance programs and grants. This means that for a lot of victims, the help they need isn't there any longer.
Senator Lisa Murkowski helped introduce the bill. She spoke on the Senate floor about what funding shortages have meant for Alaska organizations as calls to domestic violence hotlines increased during the pandemic.
This was everything for them. This was the difference of being able to answer the phone from somebody who has been abused, is in an awful, tragic situation, doesn't know where to go, and they phone that number, and there's nobody to take that call.
Under the new law, fines from deferred and non-prosecution agreements will go to the Crime Victims Fund for the first time. In a press release, the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska called the fund a much-needed resource. They said tribal organizations are working to develop culturally appropriate resources for crime victims, especially children and elders. And they're also planning to establish an Anchorage-based child welfare office. Tlingit and Haida Seattle Delegate Michelle Demert said the new bill means those programs will have consistent federal funding. Alaska's Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault praised Murkowski's support for that bill after it passed the Senate. The council's executive director back in April cited a drop in the federal funding and announcing grant reductions to victims' advocacy groups around the state. Southeast Alaska State Fair is going ahead as planned this coming weekend. As Mike Swayze reports, fair organizers are taking steps to ensure the safest gathering possible, even as COVID-19 cases spike across parts of Southeast.
Last year, there was no fair due to the pandemic. This year, the fair is back, but COVID mitigation is a top priority. One of the fair organizers, Maddie Wittick, says she's excited about a fun yet safe event.
The beauty of the Southeast Alaska State Fair is almost all of it happens outside. The CDC is recommending if you're going to hold an event, have it be outside. So that's really in our favor.
But there are a number of activities that won't be on the schedule this year as part of the mitigation plan.
So there won't be a bounce house, and we won't have the joust, which is the inflatable kind of warrior knock people off of a pedestal thing.
The Southeast Alaska State Fair typically draws hundreds of people from communities like Whitehorse and Canada's Yukon Territory, Juneau, Sitka, Skagway, and Haines. The event features music shows, vendors, and a slew of activities and games for all ages. There will be some changes. No live music or beer sold at the Klondike stage this year. But there still will be a horseshoe tournament.
There will not be alcohol for sale with the horseshoes, which I know is a disappointment for some.
One of the biggest changes fairgoers will see is the sign-in sheet at the entrance to track attendees.
That's really the only way that we are able to keep track of who is attending. And in the very, what we feel, unlikely event of any outbreak and the need to do contact tracing, that's how we're going to be able to do it.
Another big change will be the shorter hours.
We will not be having a late night program. We will be wrapping up for the evening at around 8 or 9 o'clock, depending on the day. You know, people hang out in the beer garden later and the late night music, everybody kind of comes together to dance. Part of our COVID mitigation strategy is to avoid that.
Organizers will make free masks available at the entrance. There will be hand washing and sanitizing stations located throughout, and social distancing is encouraged. There is a long schedule of events available at seakfair.org, culminating in headlining acts like Diggin' Dirt, a funk band out of California, on Friday night. And the Lack family on Saturday. The final event of the weekend will be a free-for-all pie fight at 3:30 Sunday afternoon.
We have a lot of whipped cream and Dream Whip, and we are making whipped cream pies, and it's a no-rules pie fight.
Transportation options include the Alaska Marine Highway System, Alaska Fjord Lines, the Haines-Skagway Fast Ferry, and there are options from Alaska Seaplanes. I'm Mike Swayze.
For KFSK News, I'm Joe Vicnicki.